On Wall Street this morning, trading is described as sluggish, and the Dow Jones Industrial Average has lost about 5 points.
That might sound like more bad news about today's economy until you realize it isn't today's economy.
The time is 9.5 minutes past the hour.
Try 9.5 minutes and 25 years past the hour. I'm Carrie Thompson, and you're listening to Playback, the go-to podcast for bringing you stories from the NPR archives that capture the glory and excitement that is a quarter of a century ago. This month, April 1984, we have some remarkable stories, like this one from NPR's Robert Krulwich about the changing face of the American economy.
There no longer is a typical American consumer. 30 years ago, we had lots of traditional families.
A working father.
A housewife mother.
A first child. A second child.
Sounds a little like Leave It to Beaver gone very wrong. But not to worry, Robert Krulwich will explain it all. We also have news this month about the AIDS epidemic. A story from San Francisco about what you can and can't do in the bathhouses. And rock critic Ken Goldfarb fills us in on the phenomenon of girl rockers, like Chrissy Hynde of the Pretenders.
She came out of the era where if you could grab a guitar, you could probably learn how to play and probably become a rock and roll star.
Mm-hmm. It helps if you have some talent, I guess. And speaking of talent, the piano sensation from West Allis, Wisconsin, Liberace, reveals the regular guy underneath that lavender mink.
My costumes are something that create an illusion of grandeur and things that don't really create any kind of sexual image.
We'll have an interview with a man who wins my award for the best case of denial that I've seen in a long time, the famous King of Bling, Liberace. And to kick off this month's episode, we would be wrong if we didn't remind you about something you might be trying to forget.
How many years has this happened to you?
Oh my God, April 15th, and I'm missing half the forms.
Do you feel as though you've been dragged through a loophole?
Another year, and I still don't know what amortize means.
Are you single and filing alone?
I'm depreciating and nobody cares.
Then you need new Taxlax.
Taxlax?
Yes, Taxlax, the gentle, fast-acting taxative. No messy forms, no tricky audits, just natural, high-fiber tax relief.
I can earn again.
The next time you feel your capital gaining on you, try Taxlax. It works, or double your refund back.
A friendly reminder from one of our many Playback sponsors. And now, for some newsy-sounding transition music. The big news in April 84 was that a team of U.S. scientists announced that they had discovered the virus that causes AIDS. Here's NPR's Danny Zwerdling.
The leader of the research team, Robert Gallo, calls the virus HTLV-3. He says it's closely related to another virus that causes cancer. But the new one acts differently. Instead of invading the body's white blood cells and making them go haywire and multiply and cause cancer, the HTLV virus kills the white blood cells, and that destroys the body's ability to fight off diseases. Here, Gallo said, is the key evidence that he's found the AIDS culprit.
Approximately 90% of people with AIDS have detectable antibodies in their serum that react specifically with this particular virus. Patients with pre-AIDS, it's about 80%, and normal heterosexuals, healthy heterosexuals, it's less than a half. It's less than 1%.
Gallo said he and his colleagues have developed a blood test which can tell who has AIDS and who doesn't. Researchers said that will help them understand how the disease gets started and progresses. By leaping into the public spotlight now, the Americans also seem to be playing a delicate game of international scientific one-upsmanship. See, the French researchers at the Pasteur Institute have also found a virus that they believe probably causes AIDS. And both the French and Robert Gallo say they think they've all identified the same virus. They're mailing each other samples this week to make sure. Well, the side that gets final credit for finding the AIDS virus first could win the cherished Nobel Prize and a place in scientific history. I'm Daniel Zwerdling in Washington.
As it turns out, that place in scientific history was finally secured in 2008 when the French team won the Nobel Prize for the discovery of the AIDS virus. And more AIDS news in April 84. Health officials in San Francisco announced they no longer would allow sexual activity in the city's gay clubs and bathhouses. The announcement of the ban fueled a debate over gay behavior and culture. Here's NPR's Frank Browning.
Since the advent of the gay liberation movement in the 1960s, no issue has so tormented and polarized the gay community as what has come to be called the crisis of AIDS. As more and more gay men have come to realize that neither a cause nor a cure is likely to arrive soon, they have been brought back to the even more horrible realization that to commit an act of love may constitute the issuance of either a suicide note or an execution order. Atop that anxiety, the campaign by health department officials and many gay leaders to ban sexual behavior in private sex clubs has left many other activists outraged. One of those is Paul Lorch, who edits the city's largest gay newspaper.
I find them the quislings, and I said to some of them, in 1946, the partisans would have shaved your heads. But as one of my friends said, they've killed the movement. The movement has lost its soul.
The principal object of his wrath is not the city's health director, but another gay activist, Larry Littlejohn, who had circulated a ballot petition for stopping sex in the bathhouses.
The more new sex contacts you have, the more chances you have, and it's like playing Russian roulette. Now, why would anybody in their right mind expose himself to 10 opportunities to get AIDS a week?
To outsiders, it seems obvious. If it's going to kill you, don't do it. Places where disease is thought to be spread should be closed, as swimming pools were closed during the polio epidemic 30 years ago. But the bathhouses and sex clubs are not pools. To both their defenders and their attackers, they are icons, institutions that address the needs, anxieties, and compulsions of a sexual subculture. Not even all gay doctors support banning the clubs and baths. Dr. Neil Schramm is president of the American Association of Physicians for Human Rights.
If you could close bathhouses, the next statement would be, since gay male sexual behavior can cause AIDS, let's prevent gay males from meeting openly, which means close the bars. And then finally, you would have to reintroduce laws outlawing sex between consenting adults in the bedroom. We have gone through too many years of repression. The gay community has finally stepped out of that, at least in California. We cannot return to that state again.
It is a theme that also concerns author Frank Robinson. He believes that the AIDS epidemic may well lead gay men to re-examine that compulsive sexual behavior in which self-esteem and happiness are equated with sexual accomplishment.
I won't deny that, gays went too far, that there were limits, and they certainly investigated the limits, but there were also reasons why. Does there have to be a change? Yes. There has to be a change, and there has to be a change on both sides. There has to be the question asked, are you happy? If society never asks that question, there is no possible way of coming up with that answer.
In San Francisco, I'm Frank Browning reporting.
Lots of people were not happy when they learned that singer Marvin Gaye had been shot and killed by his father on the morning of April 1st, 1984. Here's an appreciation of Gaye by Rolling Stone editor Dave Marsh.
You listen to those records and you know that Marvin Gaye was not just like a talented singer. He was a person or an artist who had, you know, real vision and imagination. Sense of dramatic, just extraordinary records. A tremendous feeling for time and how to lay back on that time sometimes and kind of sneak up on a beat. When he was really going, he would really just nail it. On Grapevine, he just nails all those beats, right? And it's like he's literally like a hammer pounding nails to me.
I never thought a great deal about I Heard It Through the Grapevine. After recording it, I had no idea that it was going to sell as many records as it did. In fact, I wasn't too optimistic about it at all. I had no idea that it would be released and that it would sell nearly 4 million records.
But on some of the other stuff, he's a little slinkier, a little more, and that's where you get into the prediction of what's going to happen in the 70s, where he's just totally, you know, sensual and expresses that sensuality with some very flowing and discursive melody lines and rhythms.
Talk to me, so you can see what's going on. What's Going On, released in 1971, marked a second phase of Marvin Gaye's music. It was a self-composed and produced concept album that took strong positions against war and pollution. Other hits through the 70s included the number one song, Let's Get It On. But Gaye was to achieve his only Grammy Awards for the 1982 release, Sexual Healing.
And I think what he did was, in a time when everybody else was making trendy records and doing their best to figure out what came next in terms of trends, Marvin Gaye came out and sold several million records. And if it hadn't been overshadowed by the commercial success of Thriller, I mean, Sexual Healing was an amazing success. He sold millions of records, and he hadn't had a record in years that did anything like it as well. What he did, and what did he do? What did he make? He did not make a trendy record. You know, he made a Marvin Gaye record. When I get that feeling, I want sexual healing, sexual healing. Oh, baby, makes me feel so fine. Help. Yeah, about Marvin, what stands out in my mind is, it's a funny word to use about a pop singer, I guess, is grace. But physical grace, the way he moved on stage and that kind of almost elegance that he had, and the grace with which he sang, and the again, almost elegant way in which his music moved. That's the part that pains me a lot, that we lost that the most, you know, because I didn't know him personally, but I his voice, you know, will ring in my ears forevermore.
Why should I feel? Marvin Gaye died the day before his 45th birthday. For more stories on Marvin Gaye, go to nprmusic.org and look for him in our artist A to Z directory. Should the shadows come? Oh, tell me why should I feel so? NPR's Robert Krulwich was out and about in April 84, shaking things up as NPR's business correspondent. Krulwich noticed that the typical American consumer wasn't so typical anymore, and that businesses were changing to try and keep up.
Everywhere you look, service industries are chopping themselves up, or they're getting chopped up. I have a few more examples. Could we have a little chopping music, please? Thank you. Let's begin with the airlines. Now, you know you've got your strictly business service and your commuter service and your all-first-class service and your no-frills service. There's also television. You know, in addition to networks, you've got cable's music TV, all sports TV, all news TV, all kids TV, all sex TV. And then there's department stores. These days you have chains that offer merchandise at full price with tailors and service and returns. And also now you have off-price, same stores, but with no-frills outlets. How about hospitals? I'm talking about those new luxury accommodation hospitals or the convenience with minimal stay hospitals. Telephones you already know about. You probably know about food stores, banking. Am I boring you? The technical term for what I am describing is market segmentation. But why is it happening now in so many places? Well, 30 years ago, all these same industries wanted to sell, of course, to the mass market, to everybody. So they designed a basic service. Now that service still works, but the mass market is dissolving. There no longer is a typical American consumer. 30 years ago, we had lots of traditional families. A working father.
A housewife mother.
A first child. A second child.
Remember them? The family of four. By 1980, you know how many families in America fit that profile? 7%. That's all. Yet that is the market that television and stores and airlines were designed for. Now we've got the two-worker households, households headed by singles, households over 65, one-person households, each group very big, different from the others, each with its own needs. And you can't design one service for all of them. They're too different. The only problem with all this, says Leo Shapiro, is that in some industries, those best customers are getting served at the expense of others.
It's happening at airlines, where you find towns now without airline services, and bus companies.
Telephone companies that focus on heavy users, while in the country, phone prices double. Banks that offer personal banking to big depositors, while little depositors pay higher fees, pay more for checking, and, says Leo Shapiro,
they find that they're not welcome in a bank unless their balances are high enough.
Now, it is possible that new banks or bus companies will rush in to serve all those left behind. But if that doesn't happen, the underserved, already unhappy, may turn to government and say, look, the chopping up of services has cut me out. Save me. And says Leo Shapiro, there may be a wave, a mini wave, of re-regulation.
Yep, there is a real reason for taking a look at the people who are going to be excluded in area after area after area from those things that our society is able to offer them.
But that's the future. Right now, across the land, all you hear is the sound of service businesses segmenting. I'm Robert Krulwich in New York.
Ah, there's nothing like the sound of service businesses segmenting. And if you're Andre Codrescu, there's nothing like the sound of this popular consumer product from the 80s.
I've had it with the telephone. This impertinent object with its abominable timing rings only in midst of your most intimate moments. The telephone is to tenderness what a hammer is to an egg. It has regard neither for you nor for your silences. It has, in fact, succeeded in making us jumpy and fearful, rarely out of reach of its cord, that leash by which we stand attached to the impersonal meanness out there. The worst things I have ever heard, such as the death of a friend, have come to me via the telephone. I find myself looking at it in superstitious awe as it stands perched there, seeming to demand human sacrifices. This bearer of mostly bad news has succeeded since its invention in transforming Homo sapiens into Homo interruptus. It stands accused also of murdering the elegance of human communication. Writing letters, an activity of the hand that used to connect intelligence to affection and subtlety, has all but disappeared under its brutal buzz. If I seem paranoid, consider the fact that the fate of the world hinges on a red telephone. And it occurs to me just now that Edgar Allan Poe, who was prophetic and profoundly sad, had already garnered the true nature of the telephone long before it became a household word. Perched there by the bust of Pallas, it could be nothing else. The raven with its nevermore is a telephone. The weird, omen-heavy bird of our poet of sorrow is a large black telephone.
Poet and writer Andre Codrescu. I wonder if he's packing one of those cordless things, those cell phone things today. And speaking of cutting-edge technology, Apple introduced its second attempt to make inroads into the home computer market. They called it the Apple IIc. NPR's Noah Adams talked to Fred Tegnatio.
People have found mostly that they don't program the computer themselves, just as they don't record their own records, but they go out to a store and buy a record, and to use a computer, they go out and buy software.
The Macintosh, the selling point there seemed to be, and the sales figures, I guess, bear this out, that it was an easy computer to learn and to use. Can that be said of the Apple IIc?
Yes, it comes with a nice little packaged disk that when you put it in into the drive, the computer teaches you about itself. It goes through a number of little activities, and as you work through the activities, you start to acquire some actual hands-on experience using the computer. And so it's changing the marketplace. I think we're not looking so much at the really low-end computers anymore, around 200. The big buying, I think, in 1984, 1985, will be around $1,000 to $2,000. And so that's where this new Apple fits in. The merchandising and advertising of this computer will be oriented toward women and girls. And I, for one, am very happy to see that because to date, most of the computers have been oriented strictly to men and boys.
I knew there was a reason I was attracted to that particular Apple product, although I would prefer something in pink.
It's time once again for Ask Mr. Science. So let's ask Mr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Well, Mr. Science, here's a question from Maud Bod from Apple Valley who writes, "Dear Mr. Science, why do all computerized things, such as digital watches, phone answering machines, and computers themselves, make a high-pitched beeping noise? Is this the natural noise of computers, or is it an agreed-upon standard by those who make these machines?"
It is the cry of the semiconductors inside each machine. These little sandwiches of semi-precious elements are constantly subjected to voltages that cause them to wince and cry out. Sharp little cries like a puppy makes when you accidentally step on its tail. We could waste a lot of time feeling sorry for semiconductors, but it's not really worth it because they could care less what happens to us. This total indifference on their part is what causes so many computers to be down so much of the time.
Thank you, Mr. Science. Send your science questions to Ask Mr. Science. Remember, he knows more than you do.
I have a master's degree
in science.
Science!
Science! I'm Carrie Thompson, and you're listening to Playback. Our next guest on this month's Playback was what I would consider a very curious entertainer. He started out as a classical pianist, and then at some point early in his career, he got seriously into the bling. Walter Valentino Liberace talked with Bob Edwards.
My costumes, of course, have reached the ultimate in outrageous splendor because they've become a very expensive joke. I spend more than $1 million a year on my wardrobe now.
Oh, my. Now it's furs and jewels, huh?
Yes, diamond buttons and what have you. I recently was challenged by the IRS in Los Angeles, who claimed that I could wear my costume socially. So I put on one of my most elaborate flamboyant costumes, one which I'm going to be wearing at Radio City Music Hall. And I went down to the IRS offices, and they had to get the mounted police to get me out of the building. But I won my case because they realized I couldn't wear my costume socially, and therefore they were completely tax deductible.
You've said that you know just how far to go with it, that you wouldn't do a Boy George, for example.
I don't think I'd ever have to because my costumes are something that create an illusion of grandeur and splendor and things that don't really create any kind of sexual image. Like Boy George is openly admits that he loves dressing the way he does and making himself up to look beautiful like a lot of people think he does look very beautiful. What I like about him is the fact that he's a very sincere, poignant performer. I love his singing. I love his voice. And the songs, the material that he writes for himself, you don't want to hurt me, and songs of that nature.
Do you really want to hurt me? Do you really want to make me cry?
I haven't asked you about the candelabra.
It's something that I stumbled upon by going to see a movie based on the life of Chopin in 1945. It was called A Song to Remember. And the candelabra was a very important prop in the movie.
Could you have ever been a straight symphony pianist? I mean, could you have done an Andre Watts or whatever? You know, just come.
Well, I started my career out as a serious concert pianist. I discovered after television that I had for many years become a successful unknown. In other words, I made a good annual income, but the man on the street really didn't know I existed until after television. And then suddenly I found myself playing to thousands and millions of people instead of a few hundred at a time. And I preferred that, and I enjoyed that much more than playing for a handful of musical sophisticates and sometimes pseudo-sophisticates. And I much rather appeal to the man on the street or the average person.
That's Liberace at the keys doing his magic. And as you can hear, he was a really talented pianist. Liberace, known as Lee to his friends, died in 1987 due to complications from AIDS. Now for a story about women and rock and roll. Here's NPR's Susan Stamberg.
For more than a decade, women have not been as interested in rock and roll as men. But some new surveys indicate a big change. Sales of rock albums to women have jumped more than 20% since 1981, and women now make up half the audience of MTV, the popular music video show. Along with listening to more rock, women are also performing more rock and are now featured on three of Rolling Stone magazine's chart of top 10 albums. Associate editor Christopher Conley says three women, Annie Lennox of Eurythmics, Chrissy Hynde of The Pretenders, and solo artist Cyndi Lauper, exemplify today's rock women, performers who have more control over their material, are more involved in the business of music, and seem more versatile. For example, Cyndi Lauper.
Her voice has a 4-octave range, although she's never been trained in it. And her sound, at first glance, sounds a lot like some of those early Phil Spector or girl group type records.
The phone rings in the middle of the night, my body yells, what you gonna do with your life? Oh, daddy, do you know you're still number one? But girls, they wanna have fun. Oh, girls, just wanna have. That's all they really want.
Behind that kind of cutesy-poo image, there's a real control going on there.
It sounds so electronic.
Well, no, that's the real thing, in fact. And one of the things she's always had to fight for is people trying to change the sound of her voice.
Huh.
But she really does have a very unusual instrument, well-suited for rock music.
What's the difference between her and Annie Lennox of Eurythmics, equally hot at the moment?
Well, if Cyndi is sort of fun and instinctive, Annie is very cerebral and very asexual, kind of, in the way she presents herself. She's classically trained. She's obviously influenced by soul music more than, say, girl group stuff.
The language of love slips from my lover's tongue.
A wonderfully cool, luscious voice with the synthesizers rather than guitars and kind of a gloomy picture. Each of the people we're talking about have gone through a lot of difficult times. They're all around 30 years old, so they're not just spring chickens.
Mm-hmm.
And they've all had a lot of bad breaks, as well as the lucky ones that have landed them where they are now.
Chrissy Hynde, for example, she was a black leather punk, drugs, booze, disorderly conduct sort of performer, eh?
Well, she certainly likes to establish that image, or she did a few years back. In fact, she is sort of the prototypic punk, that she came out of the era where people were saying if you could grab a guitar, you could probably learn how to play and probably become a rock and roll star.
Mm-hmm.
But over that period of time, she's developed into a remarkably versatile songwriter. The songs on her latest album include everything from really hard rock and roll to country stylings to Show Me, which is a very tender song about her baby daughter.
Show me the meaning of the human race, with its wars, disease, and brutality. You with your innocence and grace, restore some pride and dignity
to a world in decline.
Chrissy Hynde of the Pretenders. Chris Connolly, I read the other day in the paper something about women buying rock albums in much bigger numbers these days, and the fact that women make up half of the MTV audience. Do you think there's some connection between those buying and viewing patterns and the fact that these women performers seem to be more and more in control of their work and the music?
I'd say there's an important connection, specifically as far as role models. I think young women throughout the much of the 70s and in the early 80s didn't really have women performers they could respect. But I do think people like Chrissy Hynde and Cyndi Lauper and Annie Lennox give young women people to look up to. Intelligent, in-control people, not just frontispieces on the same old rock and roll band.
Yeah, you can't call us frontispieces anymore. I looked that word up, and I'm still not sure what it means. And seeing as how you made it to the end of this podcast, you are sure to enjoy, As a Matter of Fact, the blog that gives you the lowdown on all the wild and crazy stuff in the NPR archives. I'm Carrie Thompson, and you're listening to Playback.